Good afternoon. It is 12:02 on Monday. This is an interview I recorded on Friday with a fascinating individual. His name is Jeremy Davis, and he's the founder of what's called NELSAP, the New England and Northeast Lost Ski Areas Project. Jeremy, thanks for being here today. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks, Eric. Happy to be here.
What is it? Well, let's start at the very, very beginning. Have you always been a skier?
I learned to ski when I was 11 years old, and I learned to ski. I was originally from eastern Massachusetts outside of Boston, and I learned to ski at Neshoba Valley when I was 11. So certainly the vast majority of my life, 75% of my life. So always loved skiing as soon as I got into it.
Okay. And just out of curiosity, what's your favorite place to ski?
That's always a great question. It's a lot of times the answer I like to say is wherever I'm currently skiing. It's always great to have, whenever I'm skiing, just to be enjoying outside is a great day. There's lots of mountains that are on the top of my list. I like some classic mountains. Let's say in New Hampshire, Cranmore, Black Mountain are some of my favorites when I get to visit the state. Love skiing in Vermont, areas in eastern New York. There's so many ski areas I like to enjoy. Each ski area offers something a little bit different. Whether it's a large, resort experience or a smaller ski experience. There's just so many great ones to name out there. But, in New Hampshire, locally, Cranmore, Black, always in some of the bigger mountains like Loon and Cannon, always on top of my list.
Do you prefer those bigger mountains to the smaller ones? I can think of one in Franklin, New Hampshire, and a couple of others that are basically, natural snow, no lights, most of it's skiing on the weekends.
Yeah, those areas are a lot of fun. Yeah, the Veterans Memorial there in Franklin is a real classic skier. Got a chance to ski that once. It's all run by volunteers. I do tend to lean towards the medium and smaller size ski areas when I have a chance. There's usually a great vibe at those. I've gotten to know some of the people that own them, operate them, work at them. You almost feel like you're part of the family when you go check out those places. They don't feel anywhere near as crowded. The food's usually pretty good. You can get a lot of fun in skiing. They have some kind of funneled trails and lifts and everything like that. So, nothing against, of course, the bigger areas because, I'll do vacations and ski some of the larger mountains too. But I would say I kind of tend to prefer the medium to smaller size mountains, mainly for the vibe that they have.
What makes good snow for a skier, or is it different according to preferences?
Yeah, everybody has slightly different, preferences for skiing. I do like, faster skiing, some, high speed groom corduroy never hurts. A little bit of powder on top is nice. Good powdery, colder snow typically. Sometimes it's kind of funny that if there's been a little bit of a thaw and the snow is frozen up a little bit and then they groom it out and it's just nice and firm in the morning, especially in the early spring like this, you can really get some good fast runs on that kind of snow if it's not too icy out there. Of course, some people just really love, deep powder all the time, but here in New England, we unfortunately do not get that very often. And if we do get a lot of powder, it's usually pretty heavy or wet powder as well. So it all depends on what people, what people like. I tend to like it when it's nice and cold in the 20s, packed powder, groomed type snow, a little bit of fresh snow on top can't hurt.
Yeah, we haven't had a lot of natural snow this year.
No, it's really been, a pretty, below normal season. A lot of locations are only at 50 to 75% of normal, let alone trying to get above normal. There's been some good days, but, it's just not the level of snow we'd all want.
Well, not all of us, but what I
mean. right. As well as people that love winter.
Right. But tell me, now, the New England Lost Ski Areas Project, how long have you been involved with that?
Yeah, so I started that in my dorm room when I was in college in October of 1998. So it's been around now for almost 24 years, which is, we're older than a lot of websites that most people know about, so a lot of the major sites. So we've been around for quite a long time. And it just started as a way for me to kind of share a little bit of information that I had gathered over the years as a hobby back in middle school and high school and early college, and then to be able to to share that once the technology was available to do so, to be able to develop some basic websites and be able to share that to the whole world. And that's exactly what happened. It was crowdsourcing, essentially. You know, I put on what I knew, and then before you know it, a lot of other people were emailing me, and we had the story of these places all slowly put together, and research continued with it, and it's been growing ever since.
And it's grown into books as well. You've I can't believe there are as many lost ski areas as there are to fill all those books, but I guess they are. There's one lost ski areas of the White Mountains, southern Vermont, southern Adirondacks, northern Adirondacks, and the Berkshires in Massachusetts.
Yeah, it's just an amazing amount of places, you know, and they all have such amazing histories and interesting histories. And when writing these books, it was really great to discover and uncover these stories. And a lot of them had been kind of forgotten about. Some of these have been, you know, some of these mountains have been forgotten about for 50, 60, 70 years. And so it was nice in the books to kind of find out what was their deal and why did they close? When do they operate and what's left there now?
When did that interest get sparked in you as far as tracing the history of these places?
Yeah, I was actually on a trip to New Hampshire coming up from eastern Massachusetts. So when our family's first ski trip that we took was up to the White Mountains, up to North Conway. And on the way, we drove by Mount Whittier, saw ski, and it just really captured my attention. It had been closed at that point for about 5 years. So it had just started to be overgrown, but was still very recognizable as a ski area. But, you know, it had the gondola over the road and this abandoned base lodge that was all boarded up. And, you know, I was like, what happened here? And but there was no answers. You know, it was pre-internet. You couldn't Google it. And there was no way to find out what had happened. At least at that point, I was only an early teenager, so it was hard to, you know, find that kind of information out there when you just call random people in the phone book and hope they'll have some info, you know, back then. So anyway, it was... you know, I would slowly, you know, gather information over the years, but I just found it interesting. I was just like, what happened to these places? What was their stories? Why did it close? And, you know, on that trip, that really sparked my interest. And it was fun over the following years when I would drag my parents on family vacations and look at old road maps and see if we could try to find these spots. And more times than not, we did. It was kind of neat when you try to navigate and find a lost area at the end of a road somewhere and see what was left of it.
Have you found that these areas failed for any particular reason, or is it as many reasons as there are ski areas?
There are definitely a lot of reasons that contribute to it, and it's kind of like they all add up over time and unfortunately push the areas over the edge. So you have everything from bad snow years, you know, in areas that didn't have much snow making. If there isn't much natural snow, they're not open. And these are seasonal businesses. If they're only open for a few weekends a year, it's hard to pay the bills for that and staff that as well. You have everything from the energy crisis in the 70s, where there was no gas and people had to worry if they were going to be able to get home or not and have enough gasoline to be able to do it. Insurance costs sink a lot of these places. At the smaller community-run areas, a lack of volunteers could be a factor. You know, for a lot of these areas that are small and community-run, they are 100% reliant on volunteers, whether it was the Lions Club or the Kiwanis or other community groups that got together. And in the 70s and 80s, a lot of those groups saw declining memberships, and there weren't the volunteers to run these places. You have areas being sold because the land was more valuable for housing, or even the interstate highways. There's actually several areas used to be where the highways are, and the highways, you know, literally physically obliterated the ski area or part of the ski area. So yeah, there's lots of different reasons, but they all tend to chip away at all of them at these areas, especially these smaller places, and eventually, you know, they can lead to it closing.
We're talking with Jeremy Davis, the founder of the New England Lost Ski Areas Project, which is at NELSAP, NELSAP.org. It's amazing the amount of stuff you've got there. I have a friend of mine who traces defunct airlines, and I guess it's kind of the same thing, where you look at memorabilia and advertising and things like that from the agency. What do you do with your collection? Is it stored someplace? Is it, you know, on the walls in the living room?
Kind of, yes. It's we built a new house about 2.5 years ago, and in our basement, I now finally have plenty of space, and it's very open and organized on shelving to have all the archives in there, you know, in boxes, but organized in folders, so I can go in and go to, like, the New Hampshire collection and find all the lost areas in there. So each area has its own folder. So I'll keep all the postcards and brochures and fixtures and everything in that folder to keep it all together. And I actually don't know the number of items that I have, but it's probably 10,000 or more, you know, from over the years of just collecting everything. And then the generosity of people from the site that have contributed materials as well, which is very much appreciated. Pictures, trail maps, tickets, all kinds of stuff, people have given to the site. And then I have a Cranmore ski mobile proudly out in front of my front yard as well. So we have some ski lifts too at my house. And that always gets a lot of attention because where I live, most people don't know what that is. So I get to explain that all the time, which is kind of fun. But that's a centerpiece of our front yard.
Can you explain that to those of us who are not skiers?
Yeah, so the Cranmore ski mobile was a lift at Mount Cranmore in North Conway that was operating from the 1930s until the late 1980s. And there were two of them kind of in tandem, a lower lift and an upper lift. And it was essentially a single person, almost like a kiddie car type idea. It was a small metal car that you got to sit in open air and bring your skis with you. And it would go up track and you would then get off it and then get onto the second section and go to the top. It was also a tourist attraction during the summer as well. A lot of people went up there in the summertime and would ride the lift, you know, to see the sights during the summer. So it was one of the first ski lifts that was built, and just very labor intensive to maintain it as well. A lot of machinery, a lot of parts that need to be constantly maintained. So that kind of led to its demise in the late 80s. And the lift was dismantled, and some of the ski mobiles were put out for sale. And one of them was, I remember when on a family trip, it was being sold outside of Zeb's in North Conway, the general store there. And I begged my parents, could we buy one? It was only about $300 back then. This was in the early 90s. And of course, they were, you know, they said, no, there's no way we can get that home, which was true. There was no way to get their base. You know, we're not going to buy it. But I vowed that day to get one. And one day, 17 years later, somebody contacted me on my site and said that they had purchased the last of them out of storage and wondered if I was interested in purchasing one. And I didn't. Family restored it, and we have it here at our house here. So it's a pretty cool item. It's a very historical item, and I think it's kind of the item I'm most proud about for my ski history collection.
Do you have a family? Are they skiers as well?
No kids. No kids. So, but my brother, he used to ski, and my husband skis on occasion as well. And we have some aunt and uncle-in-laws that ski. So we try to do some family trips and with friends as well.
Well, you have a very understanding husband with 10,000 pieces of memorabilia around the basement.
Yes, he's very good at all this. We've kind of incorporated a lot of it into the design of our house. Like in one of our dens here, we've actually turned some old skis upside down and use them for shelving to display photos and have some different posters and other memorabilia around the house. So, yeah, that is true.
You're also the on the board of directors of the New England Ski Museum. Tell me about that.
Yes, the New England Ski Museum. It's a wonderful place to visit. I highly recommend that all your listeners go check it out. It's a free museum. We actually have two locations in North Conway, New Hampshire, right at the green there in the center of town, right near the train station. And that's our Eastern Slopes branch. And then we have the original museum at Franconia Notch State Park right next to the tramway at Cannon Mountain. And both are fantastic museums that tell the whole history of skiing, not just in New Hampshire and New England, but around the world as well. They're well worth the visit. Each museum is unique and different. They're not the same place with the same exhibits. They have a tremendous collection there. You can see everything there from including like Bodie Miller's Olympic gold medals. They're on display there, including the oldest, we have the book, the oldest book that has a depiction of a skier in it as well in our collection. And they're really neat places. Even if you don't ski, it's a neat attraction to go check out in either location, which are very easy to get to.
All right. And while we're talking about lost ski areas, of course, the one locally to us, Mount Whittier, and you said that was the one that kind of triggered the whole thing.
Yeah.
You went there as a child?
Yeah, on that trip we went up there, and I was like, telling my friends, "Who just stopped the car? What is this?" And it was the gondola, which goes over the road, and it still goes over the road 30 years later. And you know, it goes and starts off now goes right past the McDonald's and crosses to a subway and everything, and then goes up the mountain. And it just really spurred my interest. I was like, "What in the world had happened here? Like, what was this place like?" And you know, and it's a big place. You know, the vertical drop, the elevation change from the top to the bottom is about 1,300 feet, which is that's a good size ski area. It had several T-bars, which is a lift that drags skiers up the mountain instead of being, you know, in a chairlift. And it was pretty historical. It had been built in the late 1940s and operated until 1985, so it was nearly 40 years of operation and had gone through several phases of expansion. And that gondola was actually the first gondola and the first four-person lift in all of New Hampshire. That just spurred it on. I was like, what in the world had happened here? And in time, I was able to collect some materials, postcards, brochures, guidebooks, and kind of got little bits and pieces on that ski area and other ones. So I kind of tie it all back to that one family visit where we happened to see this totally by chance and just caught my attention.
Did it change ownership many times over the years it was open?
Yeah, it did. And it even had a little bit of a different name, too. It was originally called the Middleburg Slopes. Then it had several different owners and operators, you know, over the years. And eventually it was a corporation that then folded in the mid-1980s. But it had also had a lot of financial issues, too. They didn't have a lot of snowmaking either there. And snowmaking is really the trick for a lot of medium and larger sized mountains to be able to be successful, because it allows you to kind of beat Mother Nature at her own game. And it didn't have a lot of snowmaking, if at all. And some bad years of snow, you know, helped lead to more financial issues. And then eventually its closure in the mid-80s as well.
Was that just from a climactic standpoint, or were there other factors as well?
Yeah, you know, in New England, our winters are very variable. Everybody, you know, can relate that, you know, every winter is different. Some winters are snowy and cold, and other winters are snowy, but then it warms right up and you get pouring rain, and other winters you seem like you never get snow. So there's a lot of variability. You know, over time in the last, you know, 80 to 100 years in New England, you know, snowfall has gradually been on the decrease for most locations, or especially snow depth has been on the decrease. So even though some years there has been some recent years we've had some good amounts of snow, but the actual average snow depth has been down. And that's because of temperatures warming up by several degrees, especially at night. And that allows for more thaws and more melting of the snow and less snow cover. And of course, ski areas rely on deep, abundant snow cover to operate. So that hurts them. And snowmaking can help counteract some of that, but it's very expensive. And it's capital intensive and labor intensive to make snow. So the smaller areas that weren't able to invest in those types of systems, unfortunately, are the ones that have typically struggled or closed over the years.
Are there any that are still operating as far as on a for-profit basis?
That don't have snowmaking?
Right.
Even let's say Vermont, like Mad River Glen, which is known for its natural snow, even they have a snowmaking system. But as a purely for-profit place, boy, I'm trying to think if I can think of any here at the top of my head here. There might be a few more mom-and-pop type places that do that, but for the most part, if a place doesn't make snow, it's typically a volunteer or a community or nonprofit ski area. And if they make snow, they could still be a nonprofit type skier, but they tend to be a for-profit area. Although sometimes the for-profit part is, you know, not too they're not making a huge amount of money, but they're still, you know, on a for-profit type you know, business model. So yeah, there's very few cases of areas that are on all 100% all natural snow that are designed to be, you know, a much more for-profit type area.
Now, do you miss these ski areas, or is it just more of an academic exercise chasing the history?
Yeah, you know, I do miss these places. Some of these have had the chance to ski, you know, have now really have been closed for quite a while. Like King Ridge, I got to ski that once, and that's in central New Hampshire. I enjoyed that mountain quite a bit. Tenney Mountain, outside of Plymouth. They were also trying to, they were in the last couple of years, have been, before the pandemic, have been working to slowly be able to reopen the mountain and after it had been closed for quite a while, and that's closed. And that was a lot of fun. I had a lot of good, several good days skiing there, actually, back in college and then again in the last couple of years prior to COVID. So, yeah, there are some of these mountains there that I did have the chance to ski that, you know, I miss, and there's other ones that I really wanted to get to and close before I had a chance to get there. So I do have ties to some of these mountains here, and even if I don't have any personal tie to these mountains, I feel like I gain that tie by doing the research and talking to the people that was involved that were involved at the mountain.
And so how long does it take to put one of the books together?
It's a good question. The Berkshires book took about 2 years of writing, but it stretches out. Oh, that's my latest book. But it stretches back to collecting this information over several decades. So it takes a while to collect the information and then to actually write it. The actual, when you start writing the first words, the time that you see the book in your hands, it took me about 2 years. The last 6 months of my last book, it was a lot of it. Pretty much most of my free time was spent writing and then rewriting and organizing. And, you know, when you do writing, you have some days where you could write 3,000 words and the words just pour out of you and you can just write. And there's other days where you can't write half a sentence. It's funny how that works. But I think a lot of writers relate to that. When you're in the right zone, it's no effort at all. And then other days, for unknown reasons, it can be slow going.
What is it about skiing that you love so much?
Yeah, so the thing that's great about skiing, you're outside, you're in the wintertime. That's usually a season where everybody wants to be inside, but it makes you want to be outside, and that's really important. I love being outside. I love being in the outdoors. I love the speed of going down the mountain. I love the fact that you could get in 20, 30, 35 miles of skiing in a day. You can get in 20,000, 30,000 vertical feet. You can go up a mountain 15 or 20 times in a day. You could never hike that much in one day. I love skiing with friends, family. The atmosphere, the operator ski atmosphere. If you've had a good day of skiing and go to the restaurant, go to the bar there, have a cold beer and sit at the front of the fire, it's a lot of fun too. Sometimes just meeting people that you know at random that happen to be there at the mountain that day. It's just a great sport, and people can do it at any level of ability that they have. You don't have to be an expert. You know, you don't have to have the fanciest equipment or clothing. It's just a wonderful sport, and you can ride up the same lift with a whole bunch of people and friends that are all different abilities, and people can go their own trail down and meet at the bottom, and everybody can have a good time, and people can ski from when they're 3 years old to 100 years old. And there's not a lot of sports that are like that, where everybody can kind of participate like that. I just love it. It's such a wonderful sport.
What is the triathlon club, the Saratoga Triathlon Club?
Yeah, so where I live in Saratoga Springs, New York, just outside of the city there, I'm also the president of the Saratoga Springs Triathlon Club. So it's an organization here. It's a volunteer. It's a nonprofit, about 140 members or so. And we all train together for doing triathlon races. So our big thing that our club does is we host a swim session every Thursday night during the summer months at our local state park here at Moreau Lake. And we go out and we'll do a full hour or a little bit more swim, open water swim in the lake, well organized with lifeguards and a course set up. And it's a lot of fun. I mean, triathlon, it's a good thing. Skiing season goes right into triathlon season. So once ski season's over, it's time to start training for triathlons. And that's another sport, too, that sounds like, oh, my gosh, a triathlon, you must be crazy to do it. But it's not all Ironman distances. There's plenty of short races to do. And it's also a very inclusive type sport because there's people that do it for fun like me, and there's people that do it competitively and accomplish amazing things. And so it's very welcoming. It's a great group of people because same kind of people like skiers who love the outdoors. So it's a good time. It's swim, bike, run for those people that haven't seen one or know much about it. It's the shortest race, for instance, you swim 500 yards, you bike 12 to 14 miles, and then you run a 5K, about a 3-mile race. It takes about an hour and 15 minutes to an hour 40 minutes, depending on your ability level.
Well, it would take me a lot longer than that. I'd probably drop dead first. But, we are talking with Jeremy Davis. He's the founder of NELSAP, the New England Lost Ski Areas Project. Is skiing better now than it was then?
Yeah, I would say so. We have really great technology now. The skis are amazing compared to what we had, 30, 50, 70 years ago. They're much more technologically advanced skis that make life easier when you're making turns. We have better lifts, faster lifts, amazing snowmaking, and amazing grooming. So the technology at a lot of these mountains is a lot more improved. And the overall conditions of skiing are certainly a lot better than what they were back in the past. There's some drawbacks too. There's crowds, especially in the last couple of years, some mountains have been pretty excessive. There's also now that a lot of mountains will need to start replacing lifts that are getting 40, 50, 60 years old. So there's been a few, bumps in the road, and COVID certainly had interesting impacts where people did, decide to stay home and stay closer, to where they live and still be outside, and skiing was the perfect solution to that. So, yeah, overall, it's definitely better. If people time travel back, there's a lot of nostalgia for a lot of the old days. But skiing is definitely more pleasant now than it was back in the past. We just, unfortunately, are missing a lot of the places that were really cool and fun that have closed.
It's almost like the demise of the little tiny local grocery store.
Absolutely. The same thing at grocery stores, drive-in movie theaters, the local diner. All of those nostalgic type Americana things in a ski area here, in New England, I feel is also a strong piece of Americana history. We've had over 625, 650 of them close in New England. That's a lot of places.
That many?
Yeah, it's that many. Of course, people have to realize these are not all big mountains. There's a lot of these were pretty small, little rope toes and other places that were just really tiny. As opposed to like the big resorts that a lot of people are aware of today. But yes, there was about 650, potentially even more too. We do keep finding them. After we think we found every single one of them, there's always one or two that keep popping up.
Wasn't there one on Route 114 and was it Danvers or Middleton, Massachusetts?
Yeah, that one. I'm trying to remember the name.
I remember driving by it. I want to say Whaleback, but that's not right.
Yeah, Whaleback is on Route 89, and that's still open in Western New Hampshire. So that one is still open. The one in Danvers, let's see. Yeah, that one, there was definitely, I'm just pulling that one up. There was also Page Hill in Peabody. But there was Ferncroft Valley was one in Danvers. And there was Locust Lawn that was in Danvers. I wouldn't be surprised if that was the area you were thinking of.
That could be. Tell me about Page Hill, only because Peabody is my hometown.
Oh, okay, great. It's my father's hometown as well.
Great.
It was Page's Hill. It operated in the 50s, late 50s, early 1960s. And I believe it's the highway goes through there or right near it right now. But that, too, had a couple rope tows. It did actually have snowmaking. I even had some night skiing with it. It was advertised as Greater Boston's own ski area at that time. Even had tobogganing and skating and family fun. It was only about 20 minutes outside of Boston. And they used to blast Alpine music out of the loudspeakers at the bottom of the ski area, which a lot of ski areas did do that. It goes right by 128, goes right by it. I think it's been developed into... the highway is very close to it, but I think there's been some buildings that have been constructed on Page Hill. Okay.
Let's go back to Mount Whittier for a minute. You said it was started in the 1940s and went to the 1980s. Was it open all of those years, or were there some years that it didn't open, depending on who owned it and what was going on financially?
Yeah, I believe it was open for the entire time during that point. I wouldn't be surprised if there were a couple years in there where they had some tough seasons. You know, late 70s, 79, 1980 were some pretty bad snow years. I wouldn't be surprised if they weren't open much during that time. But as far as I know, they were open up throughout the whole time within that. And again, they were originally called the Middleburg Slopes, which was just a rope show that they had there. Then it gradually became known as Mount Whittier, starting in the late 1950s, and they kind of expanded up to the top of the mountain. But it's interesting too because it's actually not on Mount Whittier; it's on Nickerson Mountain. But that's kind of common. It seems to happen a lot where some skiers are named for a nearby mountain, but it might actually be on a different mountain.
Oh, okay.
But very close, yeah, very very close. Yeah, Mount Whittier is a little bit behind it. But Nickerson Mountain, I think, is technically the name of the mountain that it's on.
You know, I think I've heard that before, now that you mention it.
Yeah.
What is it about that particular ski area as far as what happened? I mean, here it is, it's 40 years, and you have three bad years, and it falls apart. What, you know, are you privy to what happened in those days?
Yeah, so I mean, after it closed in '85, you know, the trails started to slowly grow in. There was an attempt to reopen it called Mount Madness in the early 2000s to have snow tubing there. It was Dana Crocker tried to reopen part of it. It bought the property or was it leasing it out? Was able to try to get something started there and try to do some tubing and things, It lasted for a couple of years. I never got a chance to get over there for that, but apparently they made a little bit of snow as part of the snow tubing kind of operation there and cleared some of the slopes, but it didn't last. And I believe that the lift that they had put in there for the tubing, which was a cable tow, it's basically a cable with little plastic handles on it that you could ride up the mountain to. It's likely actually that lift came over here to New York was going to be at a private skiery behind someone's house, and then it never reopened or never got the lift to actually operate there. And then after that point, the skiery itself has, you know, the trails have become very overgrown. It's getting much more difficult to make out where they were. There was a couple ice storms too that really damaged a lot of the forest and, you know, kind of, you know, all started to, and once that was done, a whole bunch of new growth that came in. So a lot of the trails are getting harder and harder to see, but the gondola is still very much standing, and it still goes right over Route 16 there. It's very noticeable for people to see, and the lift line is oftentimes kept clear because there's power lines that go up to the top of the mountain from it.
A lot of people would, at least they, you know, based on social media postings, would like to see it come back. Do you think there's any chance of that?
I mean, it's not impossible. Nothing ever surprises me anymore, you know, in the ski business. Like, you know, if you told me, you know, 20 years ago, let's say Crotchet Mountain in southern New Hampshire would someday be owned by Vail, I would have thought people would have been crazy for suggesting that. You know, so nothing will ever surprise me in the ski history of mountains that would come back and what their future histories might be. But let's say, is it possible? You know, it would, you know, the land would have to be sold intact and would have to take a very big investor. But there's a lot of, you know, drawbacks to that mountain. It's a lot of tough terrain. There's not as much intermediate, easier terrain. There's not a lot of water right there. You'd have to create some kind of a large snowmaking reserve. You know, you have to build all new lifts. It would be a very expensive operation, I think, to bring it back. It's been gone now for so long. And that gondola lift could almost certainly not be revived. It's well past its, you know, expiration date. So it would take somebody or company with a lot of money to come in and be able to do it if they could even either purchase it or lease out the land for it. So I was feeling it may not come back. But again, nothing will surprise me.
There are lots of other things that ski areas get repurposed into. I know there's one in Northfield, New Hampshire. That is now a bike park.
Yeah, Highlands. Yep.
Highlands. Yep. Yeah, that's the one. Highlands Mountain.
Yeah.
Now, is that's the kind of thing that's very, very possible with Whittier?
Yeah,
I would think.
You know, Yeah, you know, nothing is ever off the table. You know, if somebody, the right buyer and the right investor, could come in to put in mountain bike trails or to, you know, put in a mountain coaster or some other kind of attraction. I mean, the location isn't bad. It's right on the junction of two main roads, 16 and 25, on the way up to a major tourist region for people going from south to north. Location is quite good for other outdoor activities. So, you know, in the right situation, you know, maybe someday it would, but, you know, I haven't, you know, they haven't heard anything too concrete for that to be able to happen, but, you know, nothing is impossible.
Yeah, that's very true. We're talking with Jeremy Davis, author of quite a few books, including Lost Ski Areas of the White Mountains, which is including our area here, I would think. What were some of the bigger areas that never made it?
Yeah, another one would be, let's say, Thorn Mountain up in Jackson, New Hampshire. That was a large area. It was built in the late 40s and lasted about 10 years to late 1950s. It was started by a man by the name of C.C. Plum, who owned a asphalt paving company down in Rhode Island, and had bought this as a summer, as a winter activity, because they don't do a lot of paving during the winter months. He had built this mountain up there in Jackson with two single chairlifts. They were made out of wooden towers. Not necessarily the best idea, and, you know, in New Hampshire winter. Had 1,000 vertical feet and like 15, 20 trails and several rope tows and a lodge, and had actually one of the first paved parking lots, because they were a paving company in all New Hampshire. So a paved parking lot was a big deal. In some mountains, it still is a big deal, because a lot of mountains may not have paved parking lots. That was a big one. And then right below it was Tyrol, or right above it actually was Tyrol. And that was another large lost ski area that operated from the early 60s up until the early 80s. Those are a couple of those, you know, larger ones. King Ridge is a good example of one in central New Hampshire. That would be a relatively large, you know, scale ski area. You even have things like the Cog Railway up Mount Washington, the west side, in the early to mid-2000s for two or three seasons, had a could ride the train up and ski down the tracks on the way down. And it was just kind of a novelty. It's a pretty slow lift to go up that high, half an hour up, and you ski down for 2 minutes, and the train's still up there where it left you. So it's kind of a novelty. But, you know, you have all kinds of these larger areas out there. And, you know, but the biggest majority of them are these smaller ski areas.
What is it that drives people to ski, especially when there's not necessarily any snow in their backyard? If, you know, people who live in, say, southern New England, but we have snow, is that a problem?
Yeah, no, I think you know, people want to drive, they want to travel to where the best snow and the conditions are, and that's where a lot of these you know, mountains that are still around took you know, the best advantage of that to attract people to come from larger distances to be able to ski. Of course, you know, we'll see what happens with gas prices, especially next season, and see if that has a big impact on people driving. But, you know, that's what happened when a lot of these roads got improved over the decades too. People could drive farther, so they didn't have to stay necessarily at their smaller local ski area, and they could go off to these bigger resorts that were farther away. And that led to some, you know, less traffic at some of these smaller places.
How much is the Olympics and all of the American gold medals contributed to skiing? Has that kind of inspired people to strap on a pair and give it a shot?
Yeah, and especially the 1932 Lake Placid Olympics. That was also an impetus to get people really excited about winter sports back in when, you know, especially in the middle of the Great Depression. And yeah, anytime that the Lunar Olympics are on, people get excited about winter, and, you know, winter is made to be fun. Especially when it's, you know, if it's the U.S. Olympics too, and then everybody's, you know, it's all more local coverage. That can definitely spur people on to enjoy or want to try out these winter sports. So yeah, the Olympics definitely, you know, they keep these winter sports into the forefront, you know, for a few weeks every 4 years to remind people of what kind of fun you can have out there on these mountains. Mm-hmm.
We are talking with Jeremy Davis here on WASR, the founder of the New England Lost Ski Areas Project. which is at nelsap.org. You can, I'm sure you can find his books there as well. As we talk about Mount Whittier and skiing and ski areas in general, if the genie came out of the lamp and said, I will give you the property at Mount Whittier, what would you do with it?
Yeah, that could be kind of fun. I mean, yeah, if it was an unlimited budget and there was no
well,
worries.
Well, of course, sure.
Of course. Yeah. Oh, my gosh, it would be awesome. I mean, how cool would it be to reactivate and build a new gondola right over the road there? That'd be kind of fun to have the skiing there. You know, you cut trails differently. I'd add a whole bunch of new ones that were there than what were there before, which were kind of these large windswept trails that were on the double fall line, which meant that the angles kind of went down different directions going down these trails, but you can kind of make them a little more modern trails. It'd be fun to restore some of the T-bars that were actually still there, you know, if money was no object, and kind of, you know, make a more classic type ski experience, but add all the snow making in there and rebuild a nice new lodge. I mean, it'd be kind of fun to have Whittier kind of rejuvenated, you know, if I had the means and the budget to be able to do it and the permissions to do it, it would be kind of fun to bring it back and then make it a nice place in the summer too and have some great hiking and put a summer restaurant up there like they used to have. The views up there are actually quite beautiful from the top. You could see quite a lot.
Yeah, I've seen some of the pictures. It is quite a view up there, and yeah. That's the beauty of that property is it's, you know, you can use it both winter and summer.
Absolutely. Yep, make an all-year-round attraction there and add some fun other activities, you know, maybe a water park or whatever, you know, alpine slide. You can do all kinds of cool stuff if you had the ability to do it.
What is or let me put it another way, is skiing now more of a family activity, or is it more of people like yourself who may go with a friend or, you know, or a partner or whoever, as opposed to, like I said, you take all the kids and you go skiing for a day?
It's definitely all of those. You know, whenever I ski, I see a total mix of people. I see people skiing by themselves or with their spouses or significant others or their kids or in large groups or racing. And, you know, it's really for everybody. And when I'm out there, you definitely see every kind of group and pairing and everything out there on the mountain. So it's a welcoming sport, and, you know, almost anybody can do it with a little bit of practice and training. So, yep.
Okay. So I guess the next question is, what's next?
Yeah, for now, for my site, what I think is going to be next is this year we're going to be working on upgrading the website to kind of help modernize it. So it's going to take quite a while, but the site's been around for 24 years, so we need to really upgrade the infrastructure behind the website design. And then possibly write another book that could come up in the next 5-6 years, something like that, to spread that out. And then to keep things active on our Facebook page, it's facebook.com/lostskiareas, easy to remember, and to keep good content going up there and sharing some of the collection that we have, you know, on there virtually, where people can go and comment and share their information out there as well. So that's kind of what will be next for the Lost Ski Areas project. And skiing in general, we'll have to see what happens. You know, I think with COVID, it affected the ski areas, you know, but it actually kind of affected them in a interestingly positive way, where, again, they saw a lot more traffic as people stayed closer to home. And that could help keep some of these areas going for longer because they're going to have, you know, more people interested and remember the good times they had at the mountain over the last few years when everything was under a lot of stress. So we'll see. Hopefully we won't see any more areas closing.
So the future looks bright for skiing.
I think so. Yep. Things will, you know, in the ski industry, technology is going to keep improving, you know, to help try to counteract what can be happening with, you know, a gradually warming climate, or these skiers will try to find other activities that can be able to do. But, you know, certainly in the near future, you know, I'm optimistic.
What about the concept of a mega resort where you've got skiing, there's, you know, hotels on the property, I'm sure they exist, and things like that, where, you know, maybe a casino, and you've got this big, giant destination.
Yeah.
You think something like Mount Whittier could host something like that? It's got the space.
It's got some of the space there. It's possible. To have if the right developer came in to build some kind of a small base village out of it, and maybe have some other activities kind of anchored to it, restaurants or breweries or other kind of shopping and everything like that. It's certainly a possibility. I don't know if I'd foresee that for Mountain if Whittier size would be able to come to fruition, but you just never know with the way the future is. And if we keep seeing more and more skiers coming back into the market like we've had in the last few years, there might be a need for more places to open or expand to. But yeah, you never know.
I've always been inspired by cruise ship commercials. You look at these things and they have a swimming pool on board. I mean, what is it that they don't have? And I was kind of wondering about that with ski areas. Is could you have this big giant, with retail shops and all of those things? Even if you weren't necessarily a skier, you have find plenty of things to do.
Yeah. And there's definitely large resorts that are out there that do have some of those facilities where they have these big villages and all the attractions there at the mountain and things that go on during the summer months as well.
I'm surprised Disney hasn't gotten into the business.
Yeah, they almost did. There was an area out in Lake Tahoe they were going to try to develop, and then they never really, or California, I think, that they were going to try to do. But yeah, it's a good point. Yeah, why some of the bigger companies haven't tried owning one of these areas or developing into a big resort.
Who owns most of the ski areas now? Are they larger corporations, private equity funds, still private investors?
Yep, there's a mix. In New Hampshire, there's definitely families that still run ski areas, or there's small nonprofits that do. You have these larger mountains conglomerates out west, like Vail, that owns Attitash and Crotchet Mountain and Wildcat. You have other smaller family-owned kind of corporations like the Fairbank Group that owns Cranmore and Bromley and Jiminy Peak and other parts of New England. So it's a bit of a mix. You have families that own them or family companies that own them. Some of them are still independent. Some of them are operated by nonprofits or even, colleges and universities. Dartmouth has their own ski area in the state. So there's still a mix of different ownerships of all these places and individuals as well.
How much time do you spend a week on the ski areas project, on the website and getting information and getting new submissions and exhibits?
Yeah, it depends on the week. It's usually between five and 8 hours or so, between maintaining the Facebook page and doing research or doing a presentation or organizing things or answering emails. So it is a good chunk of time. I try to spread it out a little bit here as well. I mean, it's an infinite amount of time could be spent on the website for sure. There's no end to what could be done with it if the right time allowed. It's a fair amount of time spent on it.
Was the White Mountains book, that was the first book?
Yes, it was. Yep. That was 2008 that came out.
And what was it that went through your mind and said, you know what? People tell me, I need to write a book, so I will.
Yeah, and actually, in this case, my publisher found me. They're the History Press, and they specialize in the history of topics that have not been written about in book form. And they had found my site and had asked me to write a book. They said it'd be a great topic to have in print. So I thought about it and agreed to do it, and so that was the first book, and that led to kind of writing a whole bunch more of it. And each book, I think, got better, and we learned how to do more research and get more materials and tell the stories even more thoroughly, leading to the Berkshire book. And last three books have all won awards from the International Ski History Association for Outstanding Regional Ski History. That's been kind of rewarding.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Can you get the books on the website?
Yes. Yep, you can go right to nelsop.org. Right at the top, I have the links on how to order them, and they can order them directly from me. And then I can that way the money goes right towards the site. You can also get it at local bookstores and other major outlets out there as well. If they order directly from me, I can personalize them and sign them, and they can get all the books that they like as well.
So they're not available on, say, Amazon?
Oh, they are. Yep, yep. Oh, they're on all those sites too. Yep, on Amazon. Yep, they're on Amazon and local bookstores, and I have a copies for sale as well.
That's fantastic. It really is. And like I said, there were a bunch of them. It was Lost Ski Areas of the White Mountains, Southern Vermont, Southern Adirondacks, Northern Adirondacks, and the Berkshires.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yep, those are the ones.
Is it unusual? You know, it kind of reminds me of the story of Howard Johnson's. It was, you know, on top of the world at one point, and now I think there's one franchise location still hanging on. Have we seen the end of pretty much of the small local ski area outside of the volunteer ones?
I don't know. The ones that we have now, you know, it depends on how the seasons are like. I think things have stabilized a little bit now. Hopefully, you know, that some of the ones that are still around can still keep on going. But you're right. It definitely it follows that same trend line as like a Howard Johnson's, where, you know, it was super popular in the 50s and 60s and then slowly faded away because it's just of all those different factors we talked about earlier. So, yeah, it does follow the same kind of a trend line. But I'm still hopeful. I'm always trying to be optimistic that the areas that we do have will still remain open. And we have just the kind of the right amount of ski areas right now to be open. So that's good. So we'll cross our fingers and hope that occurs.
What is the best thing about skiing to you?
Yeah, I just think the best part, I think, is just definitely being outside, definitely enjoying the outdoors, and the freedom it can bring too. And then it's just that every year it's just, you know, you can look forward to it. You look forward to winter, you look forward to snow instead of dreading it. So that's definitely one of the best things to me.
Tell me about Mount Whittier from your eyes when you first saw it as a child. And was inspired, you know, with this whole journey for you.
Yeah, I looked at that mountain and I'm just like, what in the world happened here? Why did it close? You know, what was its story? What, you know, why is it like this? And, you know, you couldn't go and explore it because it was kind of blocked off with, you know, fencing and no trespassing signs. I never got a chance to really get in there all that much, but it just was like, wow, look at this. And, you know, as a kid, you know, and a lot of people are fascinated by abandoned things and things that are, you know, falling apart and stuff. It's just kind of like, what happened? What was it like back then? And I always just wanted to know, what was it like? And by doing the research, eventually I did find out some of the history of it and pictures and brochures, and was kind of helped to be able to piece the story together.
So all the other ski areas kind of flowed from this one.
Yes. Yeah. And then I was like, well, there must be more of these places. And then sure enough, we started finding all kinds of other different places that were all out there. And then that led to hundreds and hundreds and hundreds to be discovered. Once I discovered this was not just an isolated phenomenon, but I just started skiing too. So I really didn't know anything about history and what areas were out there, and only skied a couple places at that point. Now I think I've skied over 110 ski areas. So I've been out quite a lot of different spots. And have a better feel of what the world of ski history and the history of all these places is like. That was the mountain that started it all. That was the first one that I'd ever seen that had closed, and just wondered what it was all about.
I have heard. I'm not a skier, so I don't know what the current prices are. But I've been heard that a day of skiing can be pretty hard on a budget.
It can be. Yeah, there's some mountains that charge into the high 100s for one day of skiing, and that's for a holiday if you were just to show up. Smaller mountains, though, some of these community-run areas can be way, way, way cheaper than that. So you might hear a super high price for a ticket, but there might be places that are $15, $20, $25, which isn't bad at all. And then you can also buy a season pass for mountains, too. If you ski a lot, it's a great way to get your price per visit down quite a bit. So I've been able, like this season, for instance, get my price down to about $29 per day from a couple of the passes that I have.
Oh, that's pretty good.
So yeah, I'll take it. It beats paying $150 or $100 or $120 or whatever it is at some mountains. So there's ways around it. You know, it's those kinds of tickets, people just showing up at random to buy tickets. A lot of that trend has been kind of away from that. People typically buy things online and save money and buy it early at a discount. Or they buy a pass, but if there are mountains there where you do just show up, that it can be well into the hundreds. And then I always say, if it's going to be a day of skiing like that, you better be there when the lifts open and ski until your legs fall off, because it's that expensive. You might as well, you know, you got to really enjoy being on the mountain the whole day for that case, if you're going to be spending that kind of money.
What is it about the après ski that makes or breaks a resort?
Yeah, I think, you know, the après ski season scene is a big part of these mountains, where people, after their skiing, go into the bar, they get a drink, they hang out, there's live music. It's also the social aspect. So it's important to the bottom line, to make some extra money at the end of the day. And it's also important for the social aspect as well, for people to have, you know, a good time, you know, after they ski, they can relax before they head on out.
Do you do anything else on skis, snowboard, tubing, anything else like that?
I don't snowshoe, or I mean, I don't snowboard or tube. I do some cross country skiing if I'm in the mood for it, and I do snowshoeing as well, also when I'm in the mood for it. I definitely tend to be more downhill skiing, but I have those options, you know, to be able to do those other sports too.
Now, you said you live in right near Saratoga Springs. Are there any local ski areas where you are within a reasonable drive?
Mm-hmm. Yep, there's West Mountain in Queensbury, New York. It's about 20 minutes from my house. And there is also Gore Mountain is close by. It's a state-run area here in New York, and I was actually there this morning. And it was very warm, spring skiing for sure, and that's one of the mountains I have my pass to. And I also have a pass to the Indy Pass, which is good for two tickets at a whole bunch of different mountains, independent mountains across New England and the country as well. So I kind of have my home mountain at Gore, but then I can use the Indy Pass to ski a whole bunch of other places, including that West Mountain that's close by. So got a couple of mountains that are within an hour of here. Willard Mountain's another smaller one here as well. Today was day 30 on the slopes, so I'll take it.
Not bad for a season.
Yeah, not too shabby.
And there was still snow on the ground this morning, you said, where you are.
Yeah. Yep, the skiing was good. The snow here locally is melting very fast. Like, you know, outside of the mountains is melting very rapidly, so it's not going to be around much longer. It was a nice warm day to be out there this morning. Got pretty slushy pretty quickly though, so I only ended up going for about 4 hours. But it was nice to be out for 4 hours.
What is it about machine groomed snow? I know I have some skiing friends that regard it as the equivalent of instant coffee. You know, it's better than nothing, but do you feel that way, or is natural snow better?
Well, natural snow is all well and good, but it's irregular and erratic when it happens, and it doesn't have the same density as man-made snow. Man-made snow is denser snow. It's still real snow. It's not fake snow. It's real snow. It's just made of a different process by technology, but it can last. It lasts a lot longer, so it's a type of snow that we do need to have, and it's a firmer snow, but we just, you know, we couldn't operate skiers with just natural snow for the most part. Yeah, you know, in the Northeast, it wouldn't hold up to traffic, so skier traffic. So, you know, it's not bad. The grooming can groom it all out pretty good, and the skiers get pretty good at kind of making the man-made snow at the right temperatures to not make it too icy out there. So it just depends. I mean, you know, a lot of people, you know, really like that deep powder snow, but we're just not going to get that here in New England or the Northeast very often.
Okay. We have a couple of minutes left here on WASR as we talk with Jeremy Davis. Are there any hidden trivia or hidden lore of Mount Whittier that you can think of off the top of your head?
I think people don't know. Well, they actually have the gondolas that were running there, at least last time I went by, were still outside the bottom of the base of the gondola there. At the gift shop that's there. It's not a ski shop or anything like that. It's a gift shop that was there used to be called Tramway Artisans. I'm not sure what it's called now, but the gondolas were still there, which were pretty cool. So people can actually still go and see them. And actually, one of the T-bar lifts there, I talked about that dragging the skiers up the slopes, some of that material came from that Thor Mountain in Jackson. Some of the equipment from that old lift was moved over there to Whittier, where it helped to reconstruct that lift as well. So that was kind of a neat thing, where a piece of the lost area actually went to Whittier before it became lost for one of the trails, for one of the lifts there.
That's fantastic. Unfortunately, yeah. We are out of time, so I want to say thank you to Jeremy for spending the time with us here on WASR. Again, the books are Lost Ski Areas of the, and there's pretty much one for everywhere we are. Lost Ski Areas of the White Mountains is the one locally. You can get it at your local bookstore or nelsap.org. Jeremy, thank you for spending the time with us. I do appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks, Eric. Enjoyed speaking with you.
All right. You take care.
Yeah, take care. Bye-bye.